Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.
Hello, this is Tim Reedy sitting in for Father Matt Malone and joined, as always, by Carrie Weber. And we've been talking a bit about some of the various stories we've been reporting on this week. And we're going to transition the story that Robert Sullivan brought to the table today is a column by John Carr, who's been a frequent contributor to America. And the title is Senators, Did You Come to Washington to Take Healthcare from the Sick and Food from the Hungry? So this article's gotten a lot of attention. Maybe it was that headline. Yeah. So congrats to our colleague, Zach Davis. So where did things, maybe you can kind of run us through John's argument and then bring us up to speed on where things stand on the healthcare front.
Okay. Yeah, as you said, this has been a very popular article or column on AmericanMagazine.org, which is not surprising given the attention being paid to the healthcare debate in Washington and maybe to a slightly lesser extent the budget proposals from the Trump administration and the Republican Congress. And this is a very kind of blunt column by John Carr. As you said, he begins by saying, I have a simple question for the members of the Senate and the House. Is this why you came to Washington to take health care from the sick and food from the hungry? And he points out there's no mandate for this kind of thing. Donald Trump was elected last year, but he campaigned against cuts to Medicaid and health care, and by promising that we would have a health care system to replace Obamacare that would actually cover more people. It would be something that everybody would welcome, and this is not something that's being borne out by the proposals coming out of the administration or from Congress, which actually have very significant cuts to Medicaid. They change or they repeal Obamacare and replace it with a law that would, by the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimates, would take like 22 million people off of health care over the next decade. And the Republicans kind of paint this as this is just means fewer people choosing to buy health care rather than health care becoming unaffordable. And that is, so right now we have a very unpopular piece of legislation that's languishing in the Senate and that they're trying to push a vote on, but it keeps getting postponed because of the negative reaction to this. And this is kind of bringing all of Washington to a standstill because no other major legislation is moving while this is still on center stage. And I think this is only contributing to the unpopularity of Congress, that they seem mired in this unpopular piece of legislation and not able to move on a bipartisan approach to fixing what I think everybody agrees are some problems with the Affordable Care Act.
John Carr writes in his article, I have never seen, and he's worked, you know, in politics for a long time, I have never seen the partisan and ideological isolation and dysfunction of Washington threaten poor families so seriously and directly. And I feel like that's something that, you know, everyone, no matter what party you're from, should really be concerned about.
Right, and he quotes a former advisor to President George W. Bush, Matthew Dowd, who's obviously a Republican, and says the choice now is, do you take $1 trillion and help the poor and the vulnerable and the working class in their health care, or do you take that $1 trillion and return it to basically the wealthy of the country, which would be in the form of a tax cut? And so there is, I think, bipartisan frustration with the approach that Congress is now taking with health care. But we don't seem to have any kind of roadmap to how to get out of this because there's still resistance to any kind of bipartisan bill. They're still trying to get something through that would only require Republican votes, which would mean they could afford almost no defection in the Republican Party. But they're kind of trying to keep everybody on, you know, in a party line on this, and it's not holding together because of the popular opinion to this. And I think Congress and Washington talks in different terms than voters. When Congress says, we spend too much on healthcare, they mean we use too much healthcare and too much money is being spent on healthcare. When voters talk about we spend too much on healthcare, they mean their premiums and their deductibles are too high. And so
that's an interesting distinction.
Right. So voters are expecting Congress to address one problem, and Congress is actually trying to address a different problem, and they're going past each other, and that's one reason why there's very little progress.
Right. And then spending less in healthcare on the government sense might actually end up meaning individuals spend more.
Right.
So the concern, as you're saying, that the people think is being addressed by the bill might actually not be addressed in the way they hope.
Right, and the kind of the objective of the bill is to reduce costs for younger, healthy people. Why, you know, because that's a Republican argument. Why are they mandated to buy insurance coverage that is so broad and so generous?
Insurance works.
That's how right. That's how all insurance works. But that's it's like tax cuts. If you can promise a segment of the population your premiums will go down, or you won't have to buy health insurance at all, that's kind of an easy sell to that segment of the population, but it's going to be, the costs are going to be just moved on to somebody else.
Yeah, it's very, very difficult. And one of the things that has come up in the debates around healthcare is how much we use and spend around end of life issues and how well that is handled by both medical professionals, by families, and even by the church. And we have Michael O'Loughlin, who has written on this, and his article is on americamagazine.org. It's called How Catholic Healthcare is Fighting Against the Campaign for Physician-Assisted Suicide. So this is one particular aspect of end-of-life care. And he talks a bit about palliative care, which is end-of-life care, and how that might help guide people in an understanding of what dying sort of with dignity means in a Catholic sense, not in a campaign sense.
Mm-hmm. But it is still unexpectedly controversial to talk about it.
Right. Yeah, so this is the controversy episode of America This Week, whether gluten hosts or healthcare or sainthood. But here to talk about one aspect of that is Michael O'Loughlin. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Hey, Carrie. Good to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. So for folks who haven't read your piece yet, I wonder if you could give us sort of a quick sense of where you're coming from and what your thesis is.
Sure, yeah. So in covering kind of the church and politics and the public square, an issue that comes up more than occasionally is end-of-life issues. And physician-assisted suicide is an issue that, as you said, is quite controversial, but it's also an issue that's gaining popularity. It's legal in about a half dozen states, and supporters say they hope to take a campaign to about a dozen other states over the next 2 or 3 years. So it's something that's becoming a reality for millions of Americans. It'll be an option for people as they have a terminal illness. They can consider ending their lives early if they want. So I started thinking about, what does this mean for Catholic hospitals? Catholic healthcare is a huge entity in this country. 1 in 6 Americans is cared for in a Catholic hospital on any given day. And I was curious, what Catholic hospitals in states where physician-assisted suicide is legal, how do they deal with end-of-life issues? If a patient requests it, the church is against physician-assisted suicide, so it's not an option in Catholic hospitals, but they don't just abandon the patients, right? So I went to a place, Oregon, where physician-assisted suicide has been legal for almost 20 years. Back in 1997, they passed a law. And there's a fairly robust Catholic healthcare network out there. I visited a place called Portland Providence Medical Center, and I spent the day with their palliative care team. For people who might not be familiar with palliative care, it's a relatively new subspecialty. It's kind of similar to hospice, which is for patients who have fewer than 6 months to live. It addresses comfort, making sure that they're not in pain. It addresses symptoms rather than the underlying medical condition. That's hospice care. Palliative care is similar. It's kind of a cousin of hospice, but it's for patients who might have more than 6 months. Maybe they have a terminal illness, but it'll be years before they get really sick. And it's the same thing, kind of taking a whole person approach to medical care. So making sure that people feel like they're in charge of their medical decisions. That means working with a chaplain or a social worker. It means making sure that their pain is under correct management, so working with a pain specialist, and really kind of getting at all the concerns people have as they're facing a chronic or terminal illness, and making sure they feel at ease with the kind of care they're getting.
And there's a lot of harp music, right? That's part of it.
Yeah, so that's the fun part to check out in the article. Part of this kind of whole person care and treatment is making sure people feel comfortable and at ease. And in Portland, which, you know, the West Coast is a little hippy-dippy sometimes, but they assure me that this is a growing movement. But on the West Coast right now, at least, there's this movement to incorporate harp music into care. So the hospital actually has a full-time harp player who's part of this palliative care team. So she was a really sweet woman. She kind of let me follow her around a little bit. I got to sit in on rounds with her. And she explained that, you know, patients and their families feel more comfortable with kind of soft music playing in the background, that she and her fellow harpists, like I said, mostly on the West Coast, they believe that this kind of music, you know, lowers patients' anxiety as they approach these difficult medical issues. So, yeah, if you're in Portland and you're sick and, you know, with their palliative care team, you might have a harpist coming into your room.
Now, I actually, when I was in high school, I was reporting for our diocesan paper, and there was a woman in Massachusetts doing something similar, also a harp player. I wonder what it is about harps that maybe it's sort of like a angelic sort of, yeah, there's something about it. Because, but yeah, it's a really interesting feature to have, I suppose, depending upon how you feel about harp music. some other, I might prefer a Bruce Springsteen concert in my room.
You said in your report also that the harp player kind of observes the family dynamics and is kind of not quite a diagnostician, but contributes to the planning for the patient care.
Yeah, and so I shouldn't make light of it, because she actually, in addition to the harp playing, there's another important function she plays, kind of similar to a chaplain or a social worker. She told me that she's had several experiences where a doctor comes into a room. Now, doctors, of course, are kind of overworked, and they have a lot of patients to see, so their visits aren't always as long as a patient or family might like. In addition to that, sometimes family members or patients are intimidated by doctors, so a doctor might pop into a room, ask if everything's okay, if a patient needs anything, and often he or she is told, yeah, we're fine, we're good, thank you, thanks for stopping in, and the doctor goes on their way. But then the harp player and the chaplain as well told me that they'll stop by maybe later in the day and ask if everything's okay, and the patient or the patient's family will feel more comfortable in opening up and expressing some kind of concerns they have. Maybe they're not feeling as comfortable as they wish they were. They're anxious about treatment decisions they have to make. And they kind of open up to these people, whether it's because they're not wearing a white coat or they just feel more comfortable with someone who's not a doctor. And then in turn, the harp player and the chaplain sometimes can go back to the medical team and explain what they heard in the room. And that can adjust care, or at least prompt the doctor to go back to ask them follow-up questions. So that's kind of a feature of the palliative care team, is that it's more than just kind of straight medical decisions. There's a whole team of people who are really trying to get at what's going on with this person.
Right. And the harp playing is not entertainment or a little concert. It's actually a pastoral element.
It is. And I have to say, I thought it was just kind of a music thing. But this harp player told me that there's something about harp music that this group, anyway, believes is therapeutic in a way that other kinds of music are not. Something about the chords and the sound, which goes well beyond my music expertise. Wow. But
it makes sense. I mean, it's calming anytime I've heard it.
It seems like we need a harp channel here on Sirius. Now, Michael, one interesting part of your story, and you mentioned this, I mean, the reason you went to Portland, to Oregon, is because they've had this law in place longer than any other state. It's interesting. What happens, like, if a patient comes in and is met by this palliative care team and they say, no, actually, I'm interested in ending my life? Now, that can't happen at a Catholic hospital, but they don't cut off the conversation. What happens when that subject is brought up?
Yeah, this is what I was really curious about, that exact scenario. A patient comes in, a Catholic hospital, he maybe feels as though he doesn't want to face the end of life, either for pain or anxiety, isolation, and asks for information about physician-assisted suicide. So I talked to an ethicist at the hospital who told me just that the hospital won't provide the prescription, a lethal dose of medication, and they won't even provide a referral to another doctor. But they don't just abandon the patient. Those were his words. They said if we were to just cut off the conversation right there, the patient would feel abandoned. And that's not what we're all about. So instead, he said the team is trained to kind of get to the underlying causes of why this person wants this option. Sometimes it's because pain, although that that has really diminished in recent years. As pain management becomes better treated, as pain becomes better treated in the country, doctors of all stripes say that that shouldn't be an issue at the end of life, that we have resources to be able to control pain. Sometimes it's the patient feeling like he or she might be a burden to the family. They're afraid of high medical costs. They're afraid that families are too busy to kind of accompany this person through their death. And they say that this way they have control over being able to plan for their death, you know, down to the exact day. Sometimes it's a fear of being alone, kind of related to this fear of being a burden. It's a fear of having no one to be with you. So the team can ask these questions. The patient might say, no, I've decided this is what I want. And then they'll have to, on their own or with their family, figure out how to get that option of physician-assisted suicide. They'll have to be discharged themselves from the hospital because they won't be able to do that on hospital grounds. And sometimes that's the end of it. They make the decision and move on. But other times, the social workers, the chaplains, they're able to get the patient talking and then maybe with them explore those concerns they have, maybe encourage them to talk to their families about their worry about being a burden, or to connect them to a chaplain or a pastoral associate who can be with them through their final days. So sometimes those concerns, once they're brought out into the open by the palliative care team, can be addressed, and the patient might not choose to end his or her life early.
And I think you mentioned some surveys about people who take advantage of the physician suicide law and saying that fearing the loss of personal autonomy is one of the reasons, one of the common reasons to do it. But it's almost like that doesn't mean total independence. It doesn't mean, like you say, the hospital saying, okay, autonomy means we're going to just cut off the conversation. We're going to let you do whatever you want. That autonomy could also mean we're going to work with you to plan ahead.
Yeah, exactly. And that was that's something interesting that I found. There's this other side of medicine. So there is this movement to allow people to end their lives early, which critics say is too extreme. It's too libertarian. Maybe we're kind of pushing the personal choice side too far. But then on the other side, I found a lot of doctors telling me that medicine itself has become kind of extreme in recent years. Technology has advanced so rapidly that we can keep people alive, even as their bodies, in some cases, are begging for death. I mean, people's bodies are dying, but we can keep them breathing artificially, keep them fed artificially. And this can go on for weeks or months, sometimes years. And I found a lot of doctors, Catholic doctors as well, telling me that kind of the conversation about death hasn't quite caught up to the technology. So when we're talking about autonomy, someone might be afraid that they'll enter a state where they can no longer breathe on their own, and they're hooked up to a ventilator. And they don't want to be in that state. And they fear that once the ventilator is placed, that they won't have the choice to say, no, I don't want this. I'd rather die a natural death in some ways. So the hospital palliative care team works with patients soon after a diagnosis that could end in something like that, where there might be a need for artificial breathing machine, and say, well, let's talk about your decision now while you still have the ability to do that. And then when you get to that point, you'll still have control at the end of your life because we've planned ahead for it. So that loss of autonomy, they say, has to be considered well before a patient's in a position where he or she can no longer make the decisions on their own.
You're listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. We're talking with National Correspondent for America, Michael O'Loughlin, about end-of-life issues, and we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will continue that conversation. Stay with us.
Now, back to America This Week, live on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Hello, this is Tim Reedy, sitting in for Father Matt Malone, and joined by Carrie Weber and Robert David Sullivan. And we're talking to Michael O'Loughlin about his article in the current issue of America, which you can find at americamagazine.org, about, among other things, the Catholic Church's fight against physician-assisted suicide. And maybe, Michael, we can talk a bit about that angle, about kind of the politicization to, mangle that word, of this issue. Particular, you know, the whole conversation about death panels. So palliative care is, in certain quarters, considered, kind of like, it's likened to what's happening in Europe in terms of decisions are being made for you at the end of your life, which is contrary to what some people think, you know, we as Americans should have that choice.
Yeah, the political dimension of this, I tried to say the word too, and
good save.
So the political nature of it, it kind of surprised me, actually. Maybe it shouldn't have, but I was talking with one of the doctors featured in the story, and he was the one who brought up kind of with the introduction of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. There was an Oregon congressman who tried to introduce an amendment into the bill that would have funded kind of robust end-of-life conversations with patients and their doctors and families in order to have some of these difficult decisions kind of made before patients in that position where he has to think about removing a ventilator or coming off a breathing machine. And this became a hugely controversial issue. It's when Sarah Palin, who had just kind of lost her race for vice president, it's when she coined the phrase death panel. She had kind of drum up this fear that there would be bureaucrats, hospital bureaucrats, government bureaucrats, who would be making decisions about how much medical care a person can receive, and that when it became too expensive for the government or Medicaid or your insurance company, that you would be taken off these kind of life-sustaining measures and you'd be left to die. That was where the death panels phrase came from. It was untrue. It was kind of a political smear against palliative care. And this doctor told me that, well, we kind of moved on from the death panel talk, that the damage had been done because this amendment was taken out of the original Affordable Care Act. And he said that the stereotype of palliative care as being a way to reduce costs by drugging patients and letting them die rather than treating conditions, that stereotype has remained, and it makes it difficult for this field to really expand. He said that there are certain pockets in the country that have really embraced palliative care and see it as a better alternative to kind of treatment without end. But he said, you know, the political dimension remains, and it's a struggle for them to kind of promote this to more people.
And one of the issues is, and to bring in a current example, which we've written about, is the case of Charlie Gard in England, where a court basically decided that there was no more treatment required for this baby, whereas the parents disagreed and wanted to pursue treatment. So that's kind of the nightmare scenario that I think when people talk about death panels, they're fighting against, which is they feel like the decision is being taken away from the family. So that case, which you do refer to in your article, kind of a late-breaking development, but that crystallized some of these issues.
Yeah, it's a really sad case. And as you said, this article was written pretty well before the Charlie Gard case kind of popped onto the scene, but we did address it a little bit. And that's something the doctors in Oregon talked to me about, though, is that family members often want the best for their loved ones. They say, do everything you can. And this particular doctor who's part of the palliative care told me that sometimes when family members say, do everything you can, what they mean and what they think they mean is do everything you can to get this person back to their former healthy selves, help them become the person that, you know, they wanted to be and the loved one that we have all these great memories with. Do what you can to do that. But medically, do everything you can often means keep this person alive, even if it's in a position where they would never want to be, like we said, hooked up to machines, kind of extraordinary measures to keep people breathing when really they should be dying if they were left to their own. And he said that sometimes family members are clashing with one another. Patients are suffering for weeks or months as kind of these legal situations are sorted out. So, you know, with a child, it's different. But with an adult, this doctor says, you know, it's important to make sure that these decisions are made ahead of time. And that's a key component of palliative care, is getting these decisions down before a court gets involved, before family members begin fighting with one another to avoid these difficult situations.
So is he kind of saying it's irresponsible or even immoral not to plan ahead and not to have this discussion where you specify what kind of treatments should not be, you know, extraordinary treatments should not be used, or how to proceed?
Yeah. None of the, the doctors didn't get into kind of judgmental questions about is it immoral, irresponsible. Interestingly, the chaplain who I spoke to, who was a Benedictine monk for a couple of decades, and now he's a full-time hospital chaplain, he told me that one of the most frustrating parts of his job is kind of counseling families who haven't had these conversations. You might have siblings who one wants to keep treatment going, another thinks that the parent or loved one would have wanted treatment to end. And he said that it's really a gift when adults have made these decisions so that their families are spared this. So a child might not agree with his parent's decision to remove life support, but at least the decision has been made and the fighting won't happen. So it was more of a way to make sure that the end of life process is as smooth as possible, that people can focus on kind of the gifts that come with dying. I talked to one ethicist from Boston who works on end of life issues for the Archdiocese. And she said that end of life care often introduces family members to sides of loved ones they have never seen before, because dying is such an emotionally charged experience. And that's the kinds of things people should be focused on at the end, not fights about, you know, how long to continue treatment.
Right. Can you talk a bit about that campaign in Massachusetts? You write in the article that in 2012, the advocates for physician-assisted suicide tried to bring a law similar to that in Oregon to Massachusetts, and the church there fought this quite readily, and it was, in fact, defeated there that year.
Which we had been leading in the polls quite substantially before it unexpectedly lost.
Yeah, so can you talk a bit about how the church positioned itself there and how they sort of tried to do some outreach and whether they feel that was an effective part of why the law didn't pass?
Yeah, Robert's exactly right. This was kind of seen as a slam dunk in kind of blue Massachusetts, that this kind of personal autonomy, personal choice law would pass. I had been leading in the polls. The church got involved a little bit later in the campaign and invested some money and partnered with disability rights organizations in saying that the potential for abuse was too much, that people might be pressured into opting for physician-assisted suicide. Again, going back to this feeling like they're a burden, either financially or emotionally, on their families, that disabled people who maybe can't make decisions for themselves, that they would be coerced or pressured into choosing this as well. And the church ran a very vigorous campaign. This was back in 2012, I believe. And the ballot question ended up losing by just 2 points. So the church won, disability rights organizations won, people against this particular law won. But the woman I spoke to from the Archdiocese said that she's not sure what will happen in a couple of years when the question comes back to the ballot. I think in 2018, proponents plan to bring it back for a vote. And she said that one thing she thinks people opposed to physician-assisted suicide need to do in order to get their point across is to tell stories in a more emotionally compelling way. Have individuals who accompany loved ones through the dying process tell about the graces they experienced during that process. Be honest and candid about the pain and suffering both the person dying and the family felt, but talk about, you know, why they would not want to let that experience go. She was the one who said that there's these kind of emotional connections that come when someone's dying, and that choosing to end life early might take some of those away. So she said we need to be better at telling our stories, those who are opposed to the law, in order to kind of win people over, because there is an emotionally compelling side for proponents of the law, avoiding needless pain and suffering. So she said opponents have to be better at that as well.
And I think there is some confusion, as we pointed out in our article about Charlie Gard, about what the church teaches on these subjects. I think some people misunderstand church teaching to mean that if somebody can be kept alive, they therefore should be kept alive. That's sort of the pro-life approach or way to look at it, when in fact the church says, you know, differentiates between ordinary means and extraordinary means, and that a person is not called upon to take extraordinary means to extend their life. And at least in the case that we put forward on Charlie Gard, this ethicist weighed in saying that, you know, some of these treatments would constitute extraordinary means, or therefore not called for by Catholic teaching. But I think there is some confusion around this. I mean, the church has thought a lot about these particular scenarios, and they have ethicists working in these fields, but it's a particularly nuanced and sophisticated field of theology that maybe doesn't get the kind of attention it deserves, because it is a rich resource, and people who are at this, is not just at Catholic hospitals, I think, draw upon it to help kind of make these very difficult decisions.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And one doctor I told to, who he gets particularly exasperated about these issues, said, look, people are going to die. Sometimes it feels like we have a hard time accepting that. And the question, I think, for Catholic hospitals is, how do we make sure people die a good death?
Yeah, I think that's definitely it. It's like this kind of focus on, you know, health is a kind of ultimate good for many people, as it should be, but has in some cases, you know, kind of supplanted perhaps religious faith as kind of a focus of their lives. So like these moments where like you're losing your health become, you know, particularly fraught.
Yeah, I think it's, and the church obviously has a lot to offer. It's thought a lot about suffering, about what suffering, yep. mm-hmm. what suffering means, about what our community means in these times, about what is sort of the greatest good in a variety of situations. And if we can, as you're saying, Michael, figure out how to tell stories that show the way in which our faith and its view on suffering can really bring people closer together at the end, can help people find peace, I think it can have a lot of value in a world and in a country where we often value sort of our independence, our autonomy, our own self above all things.
I think that's right. And it's a very difficult situation, especially in the Charlie Gard case. I think we saw even the church struggling to figure out how to address this. Statements coming from the Vatican that were then walked back a little bit. It's something that no one has clear answers to, but I think it's good that the conversation is at least going on.
Yeah, Michael, we have 2 minutes left, but I wonder if in that time you can just quickly tell us one story from your reporting that gave you a sense of hope about where these issues might be headed.
Yeah, I had the opportunity to sit in with a patient, a woman, a middle-aged woman who has incurable lung cancer. She invited me to join her in an exam room where she was meeting with a member of the palliative care team, a nurse practitioner who kind of managed her case for the hospital. And, you know, she's not actively dying. It's kind of a condition she can live with for a few years. But what I really found remarkable about it was the amount of time that all of the members of this team took with her, from the nurse practitioner to the oncologist to the chaplain. And they all really spent a healthy amount of time with her to figure out what was going on. She was scared about an appointment, and she really opened up to explain why she was fearing this time. And it showed me that, you know, Catholic healthcare can be a really vital component to people dealing with very fraught medical conditions.
Thank you so much, Michael. Thank you for that story of hope. For more on this story, go to americamagazine.org, How Catholic Healthcare is Fighting Against the Campaign for Physician-Assisted Suicide. Thanks for listening today for Robert David Sullivan and Tim Reedy and myself. We hope you have a wonderful day. See you next week.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on SiriusXM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to SiriusXM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.